The Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor, already cited in an earlier lecture, summed up the radical cultural shift that occurred between 1500 AD and 2000 AD in this way. Quote, "We conceive of ourselves as having inner depths. We might even say that the depths which were previously located in the cosmos, the enchanted world, are now more readily placed within." End quote. One of the most fascinating psychological effects of this cultural shift, one which Lewis was attentive to his whole life, is the modern tendency to possess a kind of cranky irritability about my own private inner space. As a modern, I tend to think that what is inside me, my thoughts, dreams, feelings, emotions, desires, is a kind of inner sanctum, which I might sometimes share, but it's where I'm at my most real and authentic. Lewis thought that this modern tendency to psychological individualism was not only peculiarly modern, but presented a special modern obstacle to loving God. "Given that I am constitutionally reluctant to admit God into the inner chamber of my life, even when I'm committed to living externally in a moral way." In a fascinating little essay called A Slip of the Tongue, Lewis wrote this, quote, "Not long ago, I had meant to pray that I might so pass through things temporal that I finally lost not the things eternal. I found I had prayed so to pass through things eternal that I finally lost not the things temporal." Of course, I don't think a slip of the tongue is a sin. I'm not sure I'm even a strict enough Freudian to believe that all such slips, without exception, are deeply significant. But I think some of them are significant, and I thought this one of that sort. I thought that what I had inadvertently said very nearly expressed something I had really wished. What I had wanted to pass through without prejudice to my things temporal was those hours or moments in which I attend to the eternal, in which I expose myself to it. I mean this sort of thing. I say my prayers. I read a book of devotion. I pray or prepare for or receive the sacrament. But while I do these things, there is, so to speak, a voice inside me that urges caution. It tells me to be careful, to keep my head, not to go too far, not to burn my boats. I come into the presence of God with a great fear, lest anything should happen to me within that presence which will prove too intolerably inconvenient when I have to come out again into my ordinary life. I don't want to be carried away into any resolution which I shall afterwards regret. This is my endlessly recurrent temptation, to go down to that sea, I think St. John of the Cross called God a sea, and there neither dive, nor swim, nor float, but only dabble and splash, careful not to get out of my depth, and holding on to the lifeline which connects me with my things temporal. Lewis's words give a sense of the onerousness, even the fear, of letting go completely. For a modern, even for a Christian, this final sense of privacy and desire to hold on to that which is my own is potentially dangerous. Even when we're not talking about sinful things per se, but benign and simple pleasures like a mother's love and the basket with its warm animal smell, as Lewis put it in his Four Loves, or walks enjoying a landscape, or looking up old words, or as in Screwtape Letters, a cup of hot chocolate, there can be a fatal possessiveness to have them as my own and in perpetuity. And this is one of those places where Lewis turns out to be surprisingly medieval. For he teaches, like Augustine and Dante before him, that even those simple loves are perilous if they create within us a small reservation which we jealously guard from God. We're afraid not only to lose our spouses and our children, but we're even afraid to give up our little comforting daily rituals, the third cup of coffee, or for Lewis, the morning cigarette. And although these loves, in and of themselves, are benign, they silently lodge themselves within us, create barriers and walls, and make for difficulty, perhaps even impossibility, of fully choosing God. To die to myself, even the small and humble things, is a terrifying prospect. But Lewis is untiring and confident on this point. Quote, "Let us make up our minds to it. There will be nothing of our own left over to live on, no ordinary life, for he claims all, because he is love and must bless. He cannot bless us unless he has us, When we try to keep within us an area that is our own, we try to keep an area of death. Therefore, in love, he claims all. There's no bargaining with him. There is then a strange drama within. On the one hand, I want bliss. I'm naturally inclined to God, and I have within an inner wound and a longing to dwell in the fullness of his presence. At the same time, I'm afraid of God, and I don't want to admit him into the very center of my personality. I don't want to give up my dreams, my ambitions, goals, hopes, and sometimes resentments, because I don't want to die to what seems to be my truest self. But Lewis is firm on this point and stands in accord with the old stern-minded authors. You must die, even to the small things and the innocent loves, in order to truly live. Lewis's George MacDonald makes this point forcefully in The Great Divorce. There are two kinds of people, in the end. Those who say to God, "Thy will be done," and those to whom God says, in the end, "Thy will be done." And all that are in hell choose it. Without that self-choice, there could be no hell. But MacDonald reassures his charge with these words: "No soul that seriously and constantly desires joy will ever miss it. Those who seek, find. To those who knock, it is opened." End quote. In the remainder of this lecture, I would like to look at one medieval author, Augustine, in order to compare his thought with Lewis's idea of sacrifice, obedience, and love of earthly things. The 5th century Christian Augustine of Hippo is most famous for his Confessions, a work which Lewis not only knew but admired for its keen sense of interiority. For instance, in his early scholarly book, Allegory of Love, Lewis said, quote, "Perhaps there is no writer who admits us so intimately into the heart of that age as Augustine," end quote. Augustine provides us with a new light on turning inward. Augustine, for Lewis, is one of the first to explore the dark depths of the self. In any case, what has been called Augustine's spiritual autobiography, Confessions, the saint tells the story of how he had to die to the attractive gravity of creaturely things in order to be born again within, to become awakened to the reality and superiority of the interior life. Ever since he was a child, he tells us, he'd been attracted to the superficial good, the good on the periphery of what truly mattered. He loved games of ball more than study, and he loved the praise of teachers more than he loved the working of the intellect and coming to see and understand. And so rather than being grateful for the opportunity to gain the ability to read, he delighted in the carnal aspects of the story used to teach the grammar. As Augustine memorably put it, quote, "I was forced to memorize the wanderings of Aeneas, whoever he was, while forgetting my own wanderings, and to weep for the death of Dido, who killed herself for love, while bearing dry-eyed my own pitiful state," end quote. Augustine was convinced that even though we grow older, most of the time we don't grow deeper. We just become more sophisticated in hiding our inner corruption. The grown man who pursues his opportunity to grow in wealth and social prestige is not significantly different from the 12-year-old boy on the playground who loves games of ball because it gives him an opportunity to feed his vanity. Quote, "But the idling of men is called business. The idling of boys, though exactly like, is punished by those same men," end quote. Augustine even cynically reflects on how we get more worked up about what we considered uneducated accents or mistakes in grammar than we do about the sentiment of the heart revealed. Quote, "The learner or teacher of the established rules of pronunciation is held more contemptible if he drops an H and speaks of a human being, thus breaking a law of language, than if he hates a human being, thus breaking a law of God," end quote. Thus, Augustine, reflecting on his own childhood and adolescence, establishes a kind of general law that human beings are in love with shadows, not reality. We are wandering in what he calls a region of unlikeness, as he puts it. What is truest about me, my best self, is within, and it's spiritual, but I'm continually attracted to the low-hanging fruit, half-rotten and overripe, on the periphery of my being. Quote, "All the time you were more inward than the most inward place of my heart, and loftier than the highest," end quote. In other words, what strikes me as most real is that which is tangible, visible, external, and physical. And thus I spend my whole life in exile, as it were, from myself, seeking meaning outside of my truest self. Indeed, I make these external goods, which are transitory and imperfect, a part of my identity, such that I have a difficult time conceiving of myself apart from them. We rejoice, quote, through the intoxication in which the world forgets you, its creator, and loves what you have created instead of you. The intoxication of the invisible wine of a will perverted and turned towards baseness, end quote. Interestingly enough, one of Lewis's favorite authors, the gentle and loving George Herbert, seems to have been in league with Augustine, as Lewis jokingly put it in Surprised by Joy. In Herbert's poem, The Pulley, Herbert imaginatively recreates the original moment in which God decided to make man. God, according to Herbert, had a glass of blessings with which every good gift was within. He decided to pour out the entire glass on man, with one exception, the gift of rest. Herbert then imagines why God would hold out on this one blessing. Quote, "For if I should," said he, "bestow this gift also on my creature, he would rest in nature, not the God of nature, so both should losers be. But let him keep the rest, but with repining restlessness. That way, if goodness lead him not, then weariness may toss him to my breast." End quote. At this point, almost any Christian is nodding his head, finding it easy to agree with Augustine that we should turn away from sin in order to love God. But Augustine and Lewis, as we shall see, is actually making an even more difficult claim, because he's not just saying that we should uproot misguided love, but that even good loves like friendships, family relations, and our own reputation have to be killed. Augustine illustrates this difficult teaching through a story about friendship. At one point in his youth, he had a dear friend who unexpectedly died. Augustine devotes almost a half book of his Confessions to describing and then analyzing the experience of what it felt like to be without him, which those who have experienced loss and deep grief will at once recognize. "My heart was black with grief. Whatever I looked upon had the air of death, my native place a prison house and my home a strange unhappiness. The things we had done together became sheer torment without him. My eyes were restless looking for him. I became a great enigma to myself, and I was forever asking my soul why it was sad and why it disquieted me so sorely. If I said, 'Trust in God,' my soul did not obey, naturally because the man whom she had loved and lost was nobler and more real than the imagined deity in whom I was bidding her trust." As you can tell, Augustine is a master of psychology, much like his 20th century English admirer, Lewis. Elsewhere, Augustine reflects on the pleasant mingling of joy and seriousness, frivolity and compassion that make up a good friendship. Quote, "All kinds of things rejoiced my soul in my friend's company, to talk and laugh and do each other kindness, read pleasant books together, pass from lightest jesting to talk of the deepest things and back again, without differ, without rancor. As a man might differ with himself, and when most rarely dissension arose, find our normal agreement all the sweeter for it. Teach each other or learn from each other, be impatient for the return of the absent, and welcome them with joy on their homecoming. These and such like things, proceeding from our hearts as we gave affection and received it back, and shown by face, by voice, by the eyes, and a thousand other pleasing ways, kindled a flame which fused our very souls and of many made us one." End quote. After such a rhapsodic praise of friendship, Augustine, in a way that is peculiarly grating for a modern audience, continues in this way, quote, "O madness that knows not how to love men as men. O foolish man to bear the lot so rebelliously. I had both the madness and the folly. I raged and sighed and wept and was in torment, unable to rest, unable to think. This is the roots of our grief when a friend dies, and the feeling as though we were dead because he is dead. Blessed is the man that loves thee, O God, for he alone loses no one that is dear to him. No man loses thee unless he goes from thee. And in going from thee, where does he go? Or where does he flee, save from thee to thee?" In other words, Augustine faults himself with looking anywhere but in God for the fullest possible happiness. As I have hinted at, Lewis repeats this difficult teaching, especially in his Great Divorce, where he employs his psychological gift to make us sense and feel how any time a love is preferred to God, it inevitably becomes suffocating and perverting. In a particularly poignant and difficult passage of The Great Divorce, a mother, who has lost her son on earth and spent her days mourning him, meets her brother in heaven. The mother is a little disappointed to meet her brother, Reginald, because she had hoped instead to see her son. Reginald replies that she will get to see Michael, but she will need to become a denser, realer person first. How? The mother asks. I'm afraid the first step is a hard one. You will become solid enough for Michael to perceive you when you learn to want someone else besides Michael. I don't say more than Michael, not as a beginning. That will come later. It's only a little germ of a desire for God that we need to start the process. Pam, the mother, replies, Oh, you mean religion and all that sort of thing. This is hardly the moment. Well, never mind. I'll do whatever's necessary. What do you want me to do? Come on. The sooner I begin it, the sooner they'll let me see my boy. Her brother replies, But Pam, do think. Don't you see you're not beginning at all as long as you're in that state of mind? You're treating God only as a means to Michael. But the whole thickening treatment consists in learning to want God for his own sake. You wouldn't talk like that if you were a mother. You mean if I were only a mother? But there's no such thing as being only a mother. You exist as Michael's mother because you first exist as God's creature. That relation is older and closer. If he loved me, he'd let me see my boy. If he loved me, why did he take away my Michael from me? Reginald then gives a devastating reply. But he had to take Michael away, partly for Michael's sake. Human beings can't make one another really happy for long. And secondly, for your sake, he wanted your merely instinctive love for your child. Tigresses share that, you know, turn into something better. You cannot love a fellow creature fully till you love God. This level of self-abandonment is extraordinary. And Lewis continually relies on echoes from the thought and writings of the 19th century preacher and fantasy writer George MacDonald to formulate it. As we've seen, Lewis first read MacDonald when he was a 16-year-old, but his admiration for MacDonald continued throughout his life. Not only did he make MacDonald his fictional guide in his 1946 Great Divorce, but 2 years later, Lewis published an anthology of his favorite quotations from MacDonald's sermons, a collection of wise sayings which reads like the notes Lewis made to build his character. In one entry of the anthology, Lewis quotes MacDonald as saying this, quote, I am sometimes almost terrified at the scope of the demand made upon me, at the perfection of the self-abandonment required of me. Yet outside of such absoluteness can be no salvation, end quote. It feels like to admit God into this inner sanctum of my affections would be to obliterate what is really me. But Lewis was insistent that this is the only true way to be able to be truly free, free to love as expansively as we need to. It was a message he thought he found in Augustine, as he wrote in a letter from 1958. Quote, St. Augustine says, God gives where he finds empty hands. A man whose hands are full of parcels can't receive a gift. Perhaps these parcels are not always sins or earthly cares, but sometimes our own fussy attempts to worship him in our own way. Incidentally, what most often interrupts my own prayers is not great distractions, but tiny ones. Things one will have to do or avoid in the course of the next hour. End quote. This, then, is the difficult teaching of Augustine, MacDonald, and Lewis on the necessity of death to self. In the next lecture, which forms a kind of part two to this one, I'll explore Lewis's thoughts on how this gift of self is even possible.